Welcome to your KMUD News. I'm your news director, April Lewis, and I'm glad to be with you for this broadcast. On this show, we'll have in-depth coverage on more issues with the tree in Redway, muscle testing in Fort Bragg, timber theft in Humboldt Redwood State Park, a new plan for the Fortuna Depot Museum, and more. But first, a rundown of today's top stories and headlines. This is KMUD News. Starting off with an announcement from us. Redwood Community Radio will host Mudstock, its annual block party, on Saturday, May 16th from noon until dusk at the KMUD Studios, 1144 Redway Drive in Redway. The free, all-ages community celebration kicks off the summer festival season with a full day of live music, family, activities, local food, artisans, and fundraising fun. Mudstock features a full day of music with live performances by Irie Rockers, McKenu, 3D Man, The Funicators, and many more, spanning reggae, cumbia, funk, and homegrown Humboldt sounds. Families are invited to the Spoon Circus Kids Zone, opening at 1 p.m. with circus arts, games, and hands-on fun for children of all ages. Throughout the day, attendees can browse booths from local artisans, shop the Hidden Gem Flea Market, sample offerings from new food vendors, and stop by KMUD's famous coffee booth, alongside luscious libations and locally baked treats. A full bar will also be on site, with every pour directly benefiting KMUD and helping keep community radio on the air. Mudstock is one of KMUD's key annual fundraisers in support of independent community radio. The event also includes drawing for KMUD's year-long quilt raffle with last-minute tickets available on-site, a silent auction featuring Bob Massey concert posters, Grateful Dead art, musical instruments, and more collectible items donated by community supporters. Mudstock is sponsored and supported by Ink People, Creative Alliance, and Measure J. KMUD is also currently seeking volunteers to help make the day run smoothly. Community members interested in lending a hand can contact Christy at christy@kmud.org to join the team. Christy is spelled C-H-R-I-S-T-Y at kmud.org. Again, Mudstock is May 16th, noon until dusk, at our studios in Redway. We'll see you all there. Some news this morning near our broadcast studios in Redway. According to scanner traffic, a 55-year-old male suffered a heart attack at Redway Tire this morning, May 5th. Multiple units were called to the scene, and fire units administered CPR. An ambulance was called after a Reach Air ambulance was unable to respond due to weather. The patient was transferred to St. Joe's in Eureka. His current condition is unknown, but he was admitted to the hospital. A safety operation for the Eureka Police Department has been planned for the entire month of May. They will be conducting traffic safety operations throughout the month of May, focused on the most dangerous driver behaviors that put the safety of people biking or walking at risk. These violations include speeding, making illegal turns, failing to yield or provide right-of-way to bicyclists or pedestrians, or failing to stop for signs and signals. Watch out on those roads, both for the right-of-way and increased enforcement. In Mendocino news, this year marks the 51st annual Mendocino Spring Poetry Celebration. It is on Sunday, May 17th at the JD Center, 208 Dana Street in Fort Bragg. Please note that Google Maps can find 208 Dana Street in Fort Bragg, but it cannot find the JD Center. All members of the community are welcome and invited to come and experience poetry, and all of the poets are invited to read their poems. In Eureka, on May 4th, officers with the Eureka Police Department were conducting proactive enforcement as part of a Department of Justice tobacco grant operation in the area of 4th and J Streets. At approximately 7:30 p.m., the school resource officer and mental health officer observed a hand-to-hand narcotics transaction between the driver of a silver Mercedes-Benz and a pedestrian near a gas station on the 1100 block of 4th Street. The driver, identified as 59-year-old Clayton Winfrey of Eureka, attempted to leave the area but was stopped for an additional drug violation. Winfrey then fled westbound on 4th Street towards Broadway. Officers initiated a pursuit but briefly lost sight of the vehicle as it turned onto Broadway. Shortly thereafter, an EPD K-9 officer located the vehicle traveling southbound near Railroad Avenue. The vehicle stopped near the intersection of Del Norte Street and Railroad Avenue, and Winfrey fled on foot into nearby brush, where he was seen discarding items. The K-9 unit was deployed, and officers pursued on foot. Officers recovered cash and a significant quantity of narcotics that Winfrey had discarded in the brush. In total, approximately 38.25 grams of methamphetamine and 14.48 grams of fentanyl were seized. Winfrey was taken into custody and booked on felony charges. In related news, on May 4th, Humboldt County Drug Task Force agents observed Elshelkale Giddens travel from Humboldt County to the Bay Area. Upon Giddens' return, agents conducted a traffic stop on his vehicle. Giddens is on formal probation with a search and seizure clause for cocaine sales from a previous case. Giddens was detained without incident and his vehicle was searched. Fortuna Police K-9 alerted to the rear of Giddens' vehicle, indicating narcotics were inside. Agents searched the area and located 2.2 pounds of cocaine. Giddens was transported to the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, where he was booked on possession of cocaine for sales, transportation of cocaine for sales, transportation of a controlled substance, and violation of probation. And now to our main stories. We'll start off with the ongoing issue with old-growth redwoods in Redway. We spoke with Redway resident Dave Walsh, who is part of a growing effort to halt any further old-growth redwood removals, and has updates on that effort. Thank you, Dave, for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Why don't you start out, just give me maybe a short bio about yourself and then what's going on in your neighborhood.
Hi, my name's Dave Walsh, and I live down in Lower Redway where this logging has been occurring, illegal logging or unpermitted. We've been working whatever channels are possible to get this to comply with. But the ordinance which governs whether old growth trees in Lower Redway can be cut or not. And basically the ordinance states that unless the tree is in imminent danger of falling, that it cannot be removed. And four trees have already been removed from the site, which was done because the process was short-circuited. We were able to slow down the work on Thursday when they came down to cut the last tree. The CHP realized what a hazard it was because they're trying to take the whole top out of the tree with branches and all, and the thing's just going to explode and probably fly across the road, and citizens couldn't be there, and so they made them apply for an encroachment permit to close down Barcelona Road. And then the county, it seems like they really want to expedite this thing, was going to issue an emergency encroachment permit that with no notice to the public that the road would be closed. And there's no emergency to speak of. They are trying to get around the law and the county specific ordinance that protects this very unique and special area in Lower Redway. So there's lots of reasons that people have been up in arms about this situation. And luckily we were successful in stopping them to cutting this last tree, but they were going to get this emergency encroachment permit by tomorrow, Wednesday. It looks like that has also, through informing the county of their responsibilities, that no longer is going to be issued as an emergency, and that they will now need to actually go through the process of the Q-zone, which they should have done in the very beginning.
So in your press release from yesterday from the Old Growth Neighborhood Association, you talked about bringing in environmental attorneys, and specifically that Humboldt County itself could be liable if the tree is cut before full legal permitting. So could you talk a little bit about what that liability might mean?
I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to exactly what that results in, but it's enough that they have decided to not go the route that they had chosen and are now going to require that the project comply with the ordinance as it's read. So originally the county thought that they did not have jurisdiction for some reason, and they just didn't want to do the work, is what it seems like. That has now been confirmed that, of course, the county has jurisdiction over what happens on residential lots in Lower Redway.
So as a resident of Redway and just humbled in general with the last collections of these old-growth redwoods, what do you think either structurally, meaning, you know, from a change of legal, what's on the books essentially in terms of laws, or procedurally needs to change to make sure the situation doesn't happen again?
Well, the biggest problem was that the ordinance wasn't implemented, that there was confusion. You know, the rotating cast of staff, it's hard to keep the staff on the county's building and planning. There's been a lot of turnover, and so nobody knew what they were supposed to do. And so when they were asked whether they would require the ordinance, they said no. And so CAL FIRE should have made sure that they were compliant with this, with the ordinance and the laws on the books. I think the ordinance is fine in its current state. It's just that it was, you know, left unimplemented.
And then the last question I had was, in your press release, it also talks about possibly a spurious emergency encroachment permit being issued. Is that still in progress? Is that going to happen?
That was what the intention was to issue this permit today from Public Works. And it sounds like County Council has put the kibosh on that, and they are now going to the Q-Zone ordinance, you know, requires public notification, it requires alternative analysis, it requires consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Agencies. There's a number of things that need to be done in order to decide what the best alternative for this tree is. And none of that was done. You know, as of an hour ago, we're through Michelle Bushnell, we understand that is the new track that will be taken, is that they will be required to follow through on that permitting process.
Next, we have a quick update from Supervising Ranger Alyssa Berry on recent redwood thefts in Humboldt Redwood State Park. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's been going on in Humboldt Redwood State Park in terms of timber being taken?
Sure. It's an ongoing problem in the parks in this area. We have the theft site for the press release that we sent out, but we also have a bunch of other theft sites in the park. And it's various individuals. They're not always related. Sometimes they are working together. Like I said, it's ongoing. It's been going on for decades, and it's just a constant battle that we're having to fight.
And in terms of what's gone on both now, and I'm also just curious for the past, it seems like what's going on currently is they're basically taking large, already fallen logs. Is there any cases of trees being cut directly, or is that something that's only happened maybe more in past cases?
I think that's more of a past history. The stuff that we deal with more often now is trees that have already fallen in the forest.
And in terms of the public, is there anything the public should look for when they're out in the parks, and maybe just describing some of the differences between, you know, authorized activity with timber in the parks from different agencies versus what it might look like when a private citizen is doing something illegally?
Sure. Authorized activity usually will involve, you'll see state park vehicles or maybe the CCC, California Conservation Corps vehicles there. We don't remove trees that fall in the forest. Fallen redwoods are a natural part of the forest life cycle. They're crucial to the forest. They take about 800 years to decompose, and they'll provide nutrients to the forest, structure to other plants, and shelter to animals and insects. So we don't remove wood from the forest itself. Anything that you see coming out of the forest typically will not be authorized. The only time that state parks will remove trees will be if they fall across roads or trails. And in that case, we'll clear the section that's blocking the road or the trail, and we'll use that park for maintenance, or that wood for maintenance in the park.
And if folks, you know, see, as you were talking about in your release on Matole Road and other areas, if they see any suspicious activity involving timber in the parks, who should they contact first?
So if they see suspicious activity, they can always call 911 if they see someone actively stealing large amounts of redwood from the park. They can also call our North Coast dispatch.
Now, some highlights from a special budget meeting of the Fortuna City Council on May 4th concerning converting the Depot Museum into an independent, nonprofit entity.
So the question is how to address the unknown in terms of transitioning the museum to a nonprofit and how that might work. Ultimately, what we would be looking for is a community group similar to Save the Fortuna Theater Community Group to establish a 501c3 to take over operations and maintenance of the museum and the actual facility itself. The city would then create agreements for the lease and then also turning over the collection that's contained in the museum. And so those would be a long-term lease. It would not likely be a very expensive lease because we would be trying to give that facility and that operation the greatest opportunity to succeed. And the city would likely turn over the collection to that 501c3 nonprofit to administer the collection as they see fit.
So going through the transition and making it a nonprofit, is the city going to do that? So the people that are going to do it have to figure out how to get it. I mean, will they have any guidance or is there a cost to that?
Yeah, there is a cost to becoming a 501c3. And would the city be heavily involved in the development of the 501c3? No. Would myself and staff be happy to sit with them, as we did with the Fortuna Theater Foundation, to talk through how it might work? We would be happy to do that. But the recommendation is definitely for the community to establish the 501c3, and that also provides an opportunity for them to raise funds in a way that the city cannot raise funds, whether that's through raffle tickets or foundation dinners, live auctions, things like that, that the city is not legally able to do.
Can they do fundraising before they become the nonprofit? Like if they're in the process of becoming a nonprofit, can they start fundraising?
And
like
my
raffles? Or
well,
something?
And my answer is tricky because they have. So sure, can somebody privately fundraise and then turn those donations over to the city? Yes, that can happen. The city can accept donations. But I would say that becomes a little bit tricky without the nonprofit status.
So during the transitional period, what happens to that $22,000 of the accumulated museum fund?
The city utilizes the $22,000 to operate the museum.
Next, a story on grant-backed citizen sampling of mussels in Fort Bragg to test for toxins. We spoke with Leslie Kashiwada, a member of the Project Here team. If you could just give me a little bit of background information on yourself.
My name is Leslie Kashiwada, and I've been a longtime resident of the Fort Bragg area. I have a PhD in biological oceanography from Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and I became a teacher after I graduated. So I taught at San Diego State University and at MiraCosta College, which is a community college. And then we moved up here.
Could you tell us a little bit more about Project Here and how you joined up with this organization?
So Project Here is actually a subcommittee of the NOIO Headlands Working Group. And that itself is a working group within the Grassroots Institute. So if you go to Grassroots Institute, website, you'll see that there are many working groups. There's a climate crisis working group, and there's a Mendocino Vision working group, and pro-democracy working group. So the Noyo Headlands working group really looks at all things related to the Fort Bragg Headlands, which is a large piece of property to the west of Fort Bragg that used to be an industrial site. It used to be a lumber mill and was for over 100 years. So the project here came out of a group of us that saw a grant opportunity that was offered by the Department of Toxic Substances Control. So I will be referring to them as the DTSC throughout, because that's easier to say. And they had a grant opportunity for community groups to apply for money that would allow them to educate the community about what's going on at a particular toxic site. And there are all kinds of requirements and qualifications, and not can't be a landowner, you can't be a municipality, had to be a community group, had to be part of a nonprofit. And for some reason, all the boxes got ticked off, and we applied for a grant and received $150,000 from the DTSC. And if you go to our website, project-here.org, there is information about the grant itself, the legislation that made this money available, and what the DTSC was tasked to do in giving this money out. So Project Here obtained those funds about a year ago. Our mission is to educate the public about what happened at the mill site, what kind of contamination occurred there historically, what type of remediation has occurred, what still remains, what we don't know, what we do know. And so I'm part of that effort.
I know that the results are preliminary and you can't comment too much on what they might mean. But mm-hmm. Was there anything about the testing process or even the results that surprised you?
In looking at what kinds of studies had been done on the mill site, in the mill ponds, in areas that had been identified where there had been significant industrial activity, we saw things that we called data gaps. But we also, you know, recognized that this site is right on the coast, and those mill ponds are right up against the ocean. They're being held back by these rather fragile structures, dams and berms that, you know, hold back some of these toxic chemicals. And so it sort of a natural part of that was, is any of that leaking out into the marine environment? And as a marine biologist, I said, well, what about the organisms that live in that environment and that filter feed? Mussels are an excellent, called a sentinel organism or a monitoring organism, because they filter feed. And if there are any toxins in the things that they consume, then they'll sequester that within their own tissues. And we can use the money, some of the money that we obtained from the grant, to test the mussels. So we got permission from the DTSC to do that. That was one of the, you know, things that they allowed under the grant. And we tested for a panel of dioxins and furans, which was really our main concern, and which are highly toxic. And then we also ran a panel of PCBs. And so what we found in the October samples, we didn't find a lot of dioxins, and we were surprised to find that there were PCBs. And so we did a second set of sampling. So the first set was in October. The second set was in February. There are certain toxins that will accumulate in the liver. So we thought, if we're going to find anything, that's where it would probably be sequestered. And the labs also had different sensitivities of what they can detect. And so, you know, as a scientist, it's this kind of work brings up more questions. It doesn't really answer very many. It just brings up more questions. And so that's sort of where we are. Okay, we found this. What next? We're a citizen group. We have a limited pot of money. This is very expensive to do this sampling. And so we can't keep testing, but we can report to agencies.
If, you know, these toxicology reports are indicative enough of needing to take next steps, what would those agencies be looking to do, or what have they historically done in these situations?
If there was indication, for instance, that dioxins were leaking from the ponds, which there was no indication of, then they might require the landowner to do further studies. And I know, for instance, in your email, you mentioned, you know, oh, right now is the season when you're advised not to eat mussels. That advisory comes from the California Department of Public Health, and they work in conjunction with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to put out those advisories. And that's what I used to be part of, that office in CDFW that would actually put those advisories up. But that has to do with the paralytic shellfish poisoning and with domoic acid. So it's more, you know, there's a red tide and the mussels are accumulating those toxins, and therefore the mussels aren't safe to eat. And it tends to be a seasonal thing. So they just sort of have this general advisory about not eating mussels at certain times of the year, but you can use them for bait. This is different. This is like, in this particular spot, is there an issue? Well, we don't know, but that agency would know. I mean, mussels grow all up and down the coast of California, and there are many places that are just off of industrial areas. And so I would assume, I don't know for sure, that they track that and maybe say, don't eat the mussels here. But we don't know if they're going to say that here. They only just got the information from us to be seen what action they might take.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Michael McCaskill, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Bianca Frederico, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located in the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyut, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to the region. Reporting for KMUD, I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.